Welcome, everyone, to another episode of the Veterans in Ag podcast, brought to you by AGD Consulting. I'm your host, Mike DeSop, and here we explore the stories and insights from the military veteran and supporter communities who are leading the way for vets in agribusiness, ag tech, and agripreneurship. We swap stories, talk ag, and show how the grassroots nature of the ag community can be a natural fit for the military veteran. Our guest this week is Greg Putnam, president and co-founder at Little Belt Cattle Company, a Montana-based cattle ranch which provides sustainably raised 100% Montana beef to the local markets of Bozeman and Big Sky. After spending some time working in the outdoor industry after college, Craig decided it was now or never to join the military. After a successful 10-year career as a Navy SEAL, Greg and his family left the military and settled back into Montana so that his three young daughters could have the life that he had always wanted for them. As Greg tells it, there was no master plan that shaped this new direction in his life, but like many military veterans, he had a passion for ranching and cattle production and was willing to put in the extra work to learn something from the ground up. Have a listen to find out from Craig why it sucks to suck. Enjoy.
I was born in Pennsylvania, and I always loved being outside, and I grew up like hunting and fishing and stuff, and I always had an interest kind of in this, but like I didn't grow up on a ranch by any means. And after I went through college and got a kind of standard business degree, and then my cousin had gone to school in Missoula, Montana, and I started coming out here when I was in college, and just really loved Montana. And after I graduated, we ended up moving out here. And I was, at the time, I was working in the outdoor industry doing some different guiding and stuff like that. And usually during the winter time, I would do just different stuff. And I had worked at a ranch that was in Idaho, and not like a big production ranch, but did like maintenance and stuff. And just always really liked that stuff. And then I joined the Navy in late 2007. And I did that for about 10 years as a Navy SEAL. And then when I got out, our goal was to move back to Montana. Like a lot of people, I think getting out, you don't know exactly, I guess, at least for me, I knew where we wanted to be, but I didn't know exactly what I was going to be doing. And I got out and started working in more in like defense technologies. And then while I was doing that, I kind of, I had a buddy that brought me up to a friend's ranch, and I started kind of helping those guys, and just the ranching thing for whatever reason really just kind of clicked for me.
I want to ask a little more detail on how you had talked about growing up in Pennsylvania, kind of this non-conventional ag background. You didn't join the Navy right out of college. You did some work after that, after college, but before you joined, at what point and for what rationale did you decide, look, I've had enough doing outdoor guiding work, and I need to join the Navy, and not only but join the Navy, but then be a part of a special operations community. I mean, that's a big step from, no prior history there or family to going about as deep as you can go.
Yeah. It was a big change for sure. The military was something that I had always been interested in, and kind of something I had thought about while I was going to college. And I had an uncle that had been a Navy SEAL and took one of their reunions when I was basically my senior year of high school. So I was 18, and, you know, they did all these, they had guys jumping out of planes and coming over the beach, and it really kind of planted that seed, and was something I was like, this is something I want to do. And I started going to college, and, you know, there was times during that process, I kind of thought like, oh, maybe I should just, you know, go and do this military thing now. But I'm glad I finished it out. And so I finished college, and then, I had been working in that outdoor space when I was in college, and it was going really well, and I enjoyed doing it. And I thought maybe I would do it for like a year or so. I ended up doing it for, you know, a couple of years. But then, you know, obviously there was two full wars going on at the time. I had, you know, a fair amount of buddies that had joined the military, and I was also getting pretty close to the age window that, you know, basically is a cutoff to join the SEAL teams. And so I kind of got to that point where I was, either, I had to do it then, or I was going to not, you know, that door was going to close and lock. And basically, you know, I kind of went about it like, I'll just take this thing one step at a time. And so my wife and I, we weren't married at the time, but, you know, we started talking about what that might look like. And, you know, I kind of just went about it step by step where I said, well, if I get this contract to, you know, they had a contract basically where as a civilian, you could come off the street and then, you know, you went through boot camp, et cetera, and you had an opportunity to participate in selection.
I mean, you don't normally hear the phrase, we'll take it one step at a time, tied to a pursuit of such a task like that. But it does sound like that once you took those steps one at a time and realized that this was the direction you wanted to go, now you set yourself down and you said, I'm going to dig into this as deep as I can get into it.
If you can figure out kind of what your end goal looks like and back from there, right, it outlines what you need to do to get there. And, you know, that was pretty much what I did. And then each time I was like, oh, I have to pass this medical thing. I have to get this waiver. But I had all that stuff kind of stair-stepped out. And each time I took the next step, I just got closer and closer. And then you make the full commitment, right? A lot of people, I don't know, probably a lot of people that listen to this podcast realize it, but, you know, if you have one of those contracts to go participate in SEAL selection and you don't make it, they don't send you back to what you were doing as a civilian. You're right in the military.
Right. Or,
you know, I may be wrong. I believe it was like a 4-year commitment active duty with a 2-year reserve commitment. So it was 6 year in total. But just because you don't make it through that selection process doesn't mean you're out of the Navy. You know, like they tell you anyway, I mean, you're in the Navy first and then you're in whatever unit you go to. And that's true for the SEAL teams as well. You know, so it was definitely a big risk because the job Absolutely. That I was doing super well. You know, we were established where we were living, like, and it took a lot of work to get that career kind of going. And, you know, but looking back, it was one of those decisions and one of those kind of turning points where, it just really developed me as a person and professionally. And
you want those experiences to shape you, but not define you, right?
Yep.
Forever.
And I tell people all the time, especially getting out, I mean, being in the SEAL team will probably open some doors or maybe get your resume on a pile that maybe you probably wouldn't have been on otherwise. But at the end of the day, you still have to perform, you know, within whatever space that you're moving into after that. But I think, you know, some of that publicity has certainly helped people post-military be desirable hires, you know, for different companies. And there's, you know, the same people that are high performers in the SEAL team that got opportunities outside the SEAL teams are usually high performers
in
those places as well.
And
the low performers generally remain low performers.
Right. I always like to ask veterans this, Greg, and I think you have a particularly unique perspective on this. Is there one instance or story or occurrence that you can think of through that 10-year career, whether it's a deployment or not, that something occurred or a lesson was learned or you know, a particular milestone was achieved that solidified in you a perspective or a philosophy or a hard lesson learned that you still carry with you today?
Yeah, absolutely. It's hard to
narrow it down. I know.
But there's things I go back to a lot. I'd say this is probably the one that I think about now a lot in just the way that I kind of manage and run my business. But also it was just an eye-opening experience. And I was basically an augmentee at a JSOC command, and we were doing some operations, and it wasn't like let's just say the tides kind of turned not so much in our favor. And the group that I was with were some of the, you know, most experienced, highly trained, you know, just, it was the varsity level, you know what I mean? And I remember thinking to myself, like, oh, like, this is probably gonna get pretty wild. Like, we're gonna, like, this is gonna get, and the guy that was in charge of the team that I was with basically said, like, hey, get your stuff and we're rolling out of here. And we did. And I remember afterwards kind of saying to him, like, you know, I was surprised because I thought that group more than anybody else would have been, you know, kind of, you know, and they were fully capable and had done it so many times. But he recognized that kind of the tide change, not fully in our favor, where it wasn't like 100% sure that we were going to dominate that situation. And he straight up told me, he's like, if I don't know I'm going to win, I'm not playing. And he's like, we can come back next week, 2 weeks. And when everything's in our favor, we'll come back, you know, kind of on our own terms. And what really dawned on me was in other experiences I had been in where maybe you had like a less experienced or younger person that, you know, somebody kind of had something to prove, probably would have said, oh, this is my chance to get in there and prove it. Where this guy had proved it so many times, his lack of ego or his like, his ability to, he had seen other people, I guess, like be humbled. And he was so just confident in his decision, but wasn't going to rush into a bad situation for the wrong reasons, I guess.
10 years that's the big point at the seesaw, right? That a lot of folks have to decide, do I step on the other side and follow it all the way down or do I not? What ultimately tipped those scales for you to say, okay, I'm just shy of 10 or I'm right at 10, time to go?
Yeah. I mean, you're absolutely right. You get to that 10 year mark and it's for me, like I would have been taking another, I think it was like a 4-year enlistment.
Yeah.
So then you're really, you're not just taking 4 years. Generally you're taking, you know, you're deciding you're going to get out of it. And, you know, I had a career, you know, there was basically just career wise. There was a career goal that I had and an opportunity that, you know, I really wanted to do that ultimately wasn't in the cards and kind of a door got shut. And I just it gave me an opportunity to really think about, you know, what's my career going to look like here moving forward, if that's not on the table any longer. And also my kids were at an age where we had just had my third daughter. I have three girls. They're currently 10, 8, and 6, but at the time they were 4, 2, and brand new. Mm-hmm. And I remember when we lived out in Montana before, my wife and I had talked about, you know, how great it would be to raise kids here. And we used to watch these little kids go skiing. And I mean, these little kids would come bomb down.
Yeah.
I remember one day we were on a chairlift and I said, I want our kids to look like that one day. Right. And so we just started to look at, I didn't want to move out here where my kids moved out here as teenagers and miss really growing up here. I wanted them to grow up here and doing all those things. I wanted them to be those little kids that they are now that, you know, can basically ski, you know, really well. They go out and up at the ranch, they ride, they do all these things, right? But they're growing up doing those things. And I also got to the point, I guess, where, you know, that was obviously was a very busy time. You're gone all the time. I don't think people realize, you know, you deploy, but it's also that training schedule.
It's the training that kills you.
Yeah,
it's not the training that kills you. Right.
On the road, just, and there are some things too. I think you get into that 10-year window where your kids start to also realize kind of that your job's different than, you know, their friends at school. And, you know, they had friends whose dads didn't come back from some of those experiences. Right. And I also watched friends of mine whose kids got older and kind of the stress that that put on their family as their kids, you know, and I think people do, but I mean, the commitment by military families, especially families within that special operations space, it's remarkable because of the strain that job doesn't just put on the operator, but also on, you know, your family, your kids, your parents.
We sit in similar chairs in that respect. I left in 2014 after 7 years. My kids at the time, I have four boys, were 4, 2, and 6 months. They're 11, or they're 13, 11, 9, and 7 now. And they've grown up here on a small farm in Northeast Texas since I left. But you're absolutely right. The scale gets heavy towards that side that is family, both in physical people that you have, right? And the gravity of those decisions that you make beyond that point, way much heavier towards, at least for me too, towards, you know, stepping outside of the uniform instead of keeping it on. When you left in 2017, you'd mentioned you did some work in the technology industry. You had got sort of linked back up with a prior SEAL and colleague, Tim, and then you guys sort of made your way back out west again. When you landed there, back in Montana, how did you guys decide that we were going to do beef, we were going to do it here, and we were going to do it in this regenerative way?
So anyway, I got out, knew we wanted to be in Montana. And I was fortunate because Tim had started another business in the military technology space. They were kind of at a point where they needed some people. Him and I had stayed in touch. And I was fortunate because I needed a job. And fortunately for me, they were kind of at a point where they were at a place that they were able to hire me. And I kind of started out doing like business development, sale. It was straight startup. So we would do anything. There was days that I was, you know, rewiring trailer brakes and then throwing a suit on and running into a convention and trying to sell products. And, you know, we were just trying to make it all work. And ultimately we did. And that company ultimately got acquired in 2019, which kind of laid the tracks to start Little Belt Cattle Company in 2020. And in that meantime, I just kind of started doing this cattle thing, honestly, as a little bit of like a sanity project. Mm-hmm. And I just love doing it. I don't know. I can't explain why. I just really love it. And I like cows and I like working with animals. And I love the feeling of, you know, what I consider to be like providing like a true service similar to the military. Everybody talks about purpose and all these things. And yeah, it's obviously a thing, but feeling good about, you know, how you spend your time here, but also kind of what you do is important to me. And I really liked that feeling where you're like a small, you know, one cog in the wheel of this big system and in providing, you know, basically food for your community and for the country. And so I started doing this cattle thing just helping a friend to start with. And I was just doing it as on the side. And then I started looking at putting together some lease ground, running other people's cattle. And I was just kind of doing this as a little side project. In 2019, I really shifted into this space from, you know, once we kind of determined the location and we found a couple properties that kind of fit what we were trying to do. And Tim got those, you know, kind of negotiated. And then from there, you know, together I've kind of ran the operational side, but together we really drive the overall direction. And, you know, and he has another company that does arrow wildfire fighting.
Yeah. Okay.
So he's the CEO of that company. So it wasn't like he was retired and doing nothing. And he, you know, comes up and helps at the ranch and is there on, you know, production days and things. But I really just, you know, I kind of operationally, took the wheel there, and and we've been kind of building, growing from there.
Give me a sense, Greg, of the sort of scale of Little Belt. Acres, head of cattle, processing capacity, annual throughput, those kinds of things.
Yeah, you bet. So we started out with about 9,000 acres. That was like under management. That was between deeded ground, state leases, and federal Forest Service leases. And we started with 350 cow-calf pairs. And we've currently grown that now. We have, I'd say about 25,000 acres under management. And we now have, basically we take those cattle all the way through start to finish. So we have cow-calf pairs, and then we retain those yearlings, both our steers and our heifers. The steers go into our beef program as well as other national beef programs that we produce cattle for. And then our heifers go into our female replacement program.
Wow.
We also do, the livestock component is the foundation of our business. I tell people it's a livestock business. And the foundation of that is the working ranch that that basically produces those cattle. And then, as we retain those, we partnered with another multi-generational family here in Montana on a feed yard that's just east of Billings, Montana. So those steers will go into that feed yard where they're finished and become fat cattle. And at that point, they go to a processor here locally. And we're processing on a weekly basis. And our goal is to, and I'll talk a little bit about this kind of local supply chain and the upstream and downstream effects. But so we try to process on a weekly basis. And then that beef comes basically back into the Bozeman Big Sky area, where we're doing kind of this direct to wholesale model. And we currently, I'd say, are at on the menu of the top restaurants in Bozeman and Big Sky in supplying them high quality local beef, on a weekly basis.
It's so striking to me to hear you say that in 2020, you start with 9,000 acres under management, 350 cow-calf pairs, to now say in 2023, you're at 25,000 acres under management and probably 3 to 4 times that in head that you're running through there with
thousands of cattle.
Largely no prior sort of ag ranching scale experience. I think if there's that has to me, that has to speak volumes to this foundation of skill sets that you and many other special operators and many the veterans bring from that community to any space that they go to. Is this foundation of largely intangible skills that if you had said in prior to you transitioning, you're going to have all the skills you need to be successful in the regenerative cattle space at a fairly large scale, even for Montana standards, a lot of people probably would have said, no way, right? He's got no background. He's got no experience in it. He's got a year-long course from A&M that has set the foundation for it, but they would have put those odds at very low, right?
I'd say more people told me this was a worse idea than trying to be a SEAL. usually it's people who haven't done it themselves, but they love to be like, do you know how many people don't make it? Or like, oh, you didn't come from a ranch. Like, that's not going to happen.
Yeah,
but all it takes is one person who actually is from that industry or from who's actually done it to encourage you.
Right.
I would say two ways. Like, it takes a little bit of encouragement and then also a lot of like, oh, you don't think I can do it?
Yeah. Right. Right. Yeah. Let's see.
And I do special operations guy. And again, veterans as a whole, but obviously that's the group I came out of. That's where I was at my whole. So I don't have experience in other operations or other like types of,
I get you.
So one thing about special operations, I mean, I think we all get very good at, there's times you're doing things that haven't been done before, or if you've done them a bunch, you still start at day one, week one. You know, I'd shot scoped rifles my whole life. When I went to sniper school, I started at the same point as somebody who never shot, you know, long range or a scoped rifle before, right? So you get good at kind of this, like, starting from day one and progressing through. And then the community I came from, you know, it was not uncommon at all that if you had a skill set that, like, maybe needed some improvement, or you had a bad day and it was because of this, and after you got done training at 2-3 in the morning and you went to back to practice that skill set that you know were lacking in, you'd walk into whatever the space was and two or three of your buddies would be in there practicing their thing. And I just took that same mindset, that plus that kind of new guy mindset of, you know, anything is learnable, but you have to commit yourself to learning it. You have to find mentors, but you also have to realize that you're going to suck in the beginning. And to get good at anything, there's going to be a point where everybody sucks in the beginning. And
yeah,
hard to suck when you're a 38-year-old former Navy SEAL at the time. I'm 42 now. Getting started, you know, like, it sucks to suck when people are like, oh yeah, you've been a SEAL team guy, and then but you're trying this new thing and this new skill set, and you suck. And but you know, I think in the special operations community, you know, it's one of those, be careful how you judge people on day one, because on day 100, they'll probably be so committed to it that they'll put in the extra time and effort. They'll do what it takes to improve their skill set. They'll reach out to people and say, how do I get better? They'll go to clinics. And that was all stuff I had to do. In the same way too, I've told people, you know, I didn't want to make it through BUDS. I didn't want to be a Navy SEAL so I could go tell people or girls at the bar that right. You know, I wanted to do that job. Right. I wanted to be at that level in the military special operations, and I wanted to do it as a Navy SEAL. I was concerned about that job more than I was concerned about the steps it took to be able to do that job. And yeah. I look at this very similarly, where I didn't want to do it because, you know, I thought other people thought it was cool. I just thought it was cool. I liked doing it. I didn't, the same way, you know, I didn't do it because, you know, I wanted to wear a cowboy hat at the bar. I did it because there was just something inside of me that's the job. And yeah. I was committed to whatever it took to be good or better, I should say, at that job. And I've had to learn a lot. And like I said, I've committed myself to what it takes to, you know, and again, similar to military, where if you're running a ranch crew, you know, if you're in a management position in a SEAL platoon, the expectation is you're doing all the administrative stuff and all the, you know, all the other stuff that goes into whether it's training or operations, et cetera. But there's still an expectation that you're going to perform whatever that skill set or duty is. And if your skill set is lacking, you're going to lose respect and people aren't going to, you're a participant as well, but you don't have the same amount of time to be doing those skills day in, day out as the more of the operator guys. And so I see a lot of parallels in that. So it was important for me. I felt like as the person kind of running this company, was that I had to have those skills as well to be able to make good decisions, but also, it's just it was important to me to build that foundation.
Yeah.
Those skill sets. And it was scary, that when they dropped those first 350 cals and that truck pulled away and I was standing there and I was like, oh boy.
Right.
And that's where you go, like that feeling though of like,
yep. New guy time.
Kick in. But I wasn't going to let it. I just, like I said, it has been a very steep learning curve, but I think I've been well suited to like ingest the information, one, because I really enjoy learning about it. But number two, it's not the first time that, you know, I've had to basically learn something new And again, I think you just get, it makes it, if you've done it before, it makes it easier. If you've made like a big change in your life, it's easier to do it another time. And I just, again, I think it just, those experiences really set you up. And primarily you learn how to mitigate things not going your way.
Yeah.
And you learn to mitigate, oh, this didn't happen. This door closed. Oh, I'm going to try this. I'm going to try that. And that ultimately is how I was able to kind of just, you know, kind of piece this thing together. And all that incrementally has happened over time. And like I said, that the size of the land that we're managing isn't all land that we own.
Sure. Sure.
It's a deal with lease and federal and state. And those cattle, we built that cow herd, you know, really from within on those females, with a real focus on genetics and just running really a high quality genetically, like good cattle in this kind of regenerative way, where, again, as I started looking at this thing and building a business around it, you know, I saw a lot of people in this kind of regenerative space that were really focused on what was happening, you know, to the soil and to the ground. And then there was this other side where it was more focused on the overall like animal performance.
Mm-hmm.
And then kind of where those overlapped in the middle is kind of where I said, well, I didn't see a lot of people doing, you know, this more cattle performance based, most of the guys that were really focused on kind of this regenerative thing weren't so focused on the end result cattle performance.
I see what you're saying.
A lot of people focused on the end result cattle performance weren't focused on the grazing practices that got it right.
Gotcha.
And I think that's a fair statement. Yep, there's people out there. I'm not saying we're the first ones to do it.
Right.
However, I recognize that there was this kind of space in the middle that there wasn't as much competition.
It's not only the space in the middle, but it's the space up and down that production cycle that you've got. If you're going from cow calf, right, all the way through to feedlot and processor, then you can say the genetic decisions that I made in this sire line have had impact on my yield, because I'm actually getting real insight into what my production and yield actually are. And the beef production in the US is so disaggregated that often cow-calf is different than feed, is different than process. Those entities never meet. So you have a perspective and an opportunity, it feels like to me, to touch all of those various points so that you can, at the end of the day, really know whether or not your early decisions are having yield impact.
Yeah, I see the effects of our decisions. So most, like you said, it's a very phase-lined approach. And for people who are, you know, you have cow-calf guys, you have yearling guys, you have feeding guys, and then they get sold as fat cattle into packing houses. And all of those phase lines are basically a point of sale, and each point of sale has its own margin base that they're-
It's a good way to look at that, phase lines.
And most cow-calf guys, I tell people, it'd be like a beer or winemaker who's never tried their own product.
Yeah,
how do you make genetic decisions if you're not getting performance feedback, which most people aren't? We were in the program that we sell livestock to, and that's how we kind of made sure our quality assurance is where it was before we started selling into this wholesale model. But I can see the bulls that I buy and the genetics that I'm looking for. How do they directly impact the performance of those cattle on the rail, which is ultimately kind of my obsession. The overall cattle performance and then the quality and improvement of the ground that we're running and managing through good grazing practices and through basically soil improvement allows us then, there's basically two ways, to make money in cattle production. One is you have to increase your carrying capacity, and that takes either buying more land or improving the land you're on to where you can run more animals because you have more volume of forage.
Yep.
And so the way you get more volume and forage is you basically improve your soil, you improve the volume and diversity of the forage that is available, and you do all of that through grazing plans, right? And so we use this very, very, very strategic like very mindful, very set out grazing plan that is based on the size of the pasture the cattle are on, the number of cattle and the number of days based on the volume of forage that's in there. And that's the amount of days that those cattle are on that. And we try not to put the same cattle on the same pastures at the same time of year. So we're also changing around the rotation that we're moving through. And we've seen huge improvements of that ground just in the short time we've been there. Visually, the way that that ranch looks and the volume of grass that we're able to produce now and the performance that we're getting out of those cattle is indisputable when I look comparing that to, you know, similar genetics at other places or whatnot. And basically, you know, your pounds equal dollars and your performance really truly matters. And we've been, as I built this cow herd, you know, I've been extremely mindful of like what those genetic effects are gonna have on that end result and really focusing on building like a really, really high quality maternal herd and then introducing outside bull genetics that are ultimately gonna have positive impact on performance wise, you know, of those steers that are gonna go into our beef program as well as other high quality beef.
Well, look, man, Greg, I've taken up way more of your time than I should have. I want to thank you for being so generous with yours. How can people get a hold of you if you want them to? How can they learn more about Little Bell Cattle Company? How can they follow you guys on social media?
I'll get in that. And then I had two things on my little list here. I made sure I want to talk about. I think, again, veterans interested in agriculture, and if you don't have a background in it, don't let that be the reason you don't at least look into it. We started a program with Montana State University that we're calling Range to Range.
Awesome.
Basically, it's a blueprint for how you can come out of the military and enter into the agriculture space through skills bridge, internships.
Oh, wow.
And then basically what it is designed, it's the blueprint I wish I had when I got out.
You get an
internship at an actual place doing something you think you might want to do. And the goal there is to come out with two decision points. A, this is not for me and I'm going to go do something else. Or B, this is for me and how do I pursue this? Well, if you want to go down an educational path, Montana State University has a great ag program. If you're like, hey, I just want to get to work, you've got this SkillsBridge internship that gets you at least a foundation. And then through those, you know, help getting people placed at different places and or going through like Ben's program, Bear Hug Cattle Company, which is a veteran nonprofit that basically takes guys, you know, through a number of different operations and gets them a foundation in agriculture and ranching in particular, cattle ranching. And we participate with those guys. We bring those out to the ranch and we kind of provide what I call like the cross stage of that program where as veterans, we can kind of understand and we can just tell them like, hey, this is how you do it. Don't do that. Do more of this and help those guys get experience. So that's something that we've developed. I'm a big believer in kind of like making the table bigger and not making your fences higher.
Greg makes a good point in this episode that I think is worth repeating here. He recognized that it sucks to suck at something, but almost nobody is good at something the first time they try it. Even as a then 38-year-old former Navy SEAL, Greg was new to cattle ranching, had to start at the beginning like everyone else. One of those things that set him apart, though, and what sets many special operators apart, is that between day one and day 100, right, watch out. Because many of these folks will pour themselves into this new pursuit with a tenacity that allows them to advance this new skill set at such an uncommon rate, right? Starting from a skill base of zero, right, doesn't have to be a non-starter in and of itself. Many veterans possess this intangible skill and gift necessary to overcome and push through these early barriers. Specific to the cattle operation at Little Belt, right, Greg recognized that there was this middle ground between a hyper-focus on regenerative practices at one end and then animal performance at the other. Often at these extremes, one emphasis comes at the cost of certain benefits of the other.
And Greg didn't want to play at these extremes, but rather he wanted to find a place in the happy middle where he could achieve certain benefits of both. If you're interested in learning more about Little Belt Cattle Company, you can find them online at Little Belt Cattle Co. They're on Instagram at Little Belt Cattle Co. Buy a ball cap or a t-shirt to give them some support. Or if you're in the Bozeman or Big Sky area, sign up for their newsletter. They've also started a mentorship and internship program with Montana University called Range to Range. It's designed to help military members transition out and into ranching by utilizing programs like the DoD Skills Bridge program, creating internships, and partnering with the fantastic Ben Midden and his group at Bear Hug Cattle Company, who's been a guest on the show before. Thanks for listening to another episode of the Vets and Ag Podcast, brought to you by AGD Consulting. If you enjoyed this episode and think other military veterans and supporters would benefit from these insights and stories, please give us a review and share on social media. You can also find previous episodes and learn more about AGD Consulting by visiting our website. Finally, if you have any recommendations of future guests who are military veterans or supporters leading the way in agribusiness, ag tech, or agripreneurship, please send them our way. I'm your host, Mike DeSalle, and until next time, stay frosty.